From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2016 election. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Audie Cornish. 44 down, 6 more to go. Polls have closed in most states and the District of Columbia, and the vote tallies are coming in.
Donald Trump is leading in the Electoral College, but the presidential race is too close to call in several toss-up states, including Virginia, Georgia, North Carolina, and Florida.
Democrats have picked up a Senate seat in Illinois. Representative Tammy Duckworth defeated incumbent Mark Kirk.
Democrats need to flip 5 seats, 4 if Hillary Clinton wins, to take control of the Senate. Earlier, Republicans secured a seat in one key race, Indiana.
The GOP also won the governor's race in that state, but voters in West Virginia were in a ticket-splitting mind. The state went for Donald Trump, but chose Democrat Jim Justice as their governor.
Results from more races as they come in. Stay with us.
Joining us now with the latest are NPR's Sue Davis and Sarah McCammon. And Sue, I want to start with you just to get an update on what we know right now.
So as of the moment, we have Donald Trump with a narrow lead in the electoral vote with 137. Donald Trump's strength is coming through the South and through the Midwest. Hillary Clinton has 104 electoral votes, the strength of her vote right now in the Northeast and in Barack Obama's home state of Illinois. Down the ballot, Democrats have net gained 1 of the 4 or 5 seats they need to pick up the Senate. That was in Illinois with Tammy Duckworth, who defeated Senate incumbent Mark Kirk. And in the House, Democrats are not having a very good night. They have net gained only 2 seats. They would need 30 seats to take over the House. That seems very unlikely this evening.
Although I don't think the House was on the list, right, of things people thought was definitely going to flip tonight.
That's right. But a sign of how strong Democrats were doing down the ballot was going to be a sign of how well Democrats were doing overall. Mm-hmm. And this early in the evening, there's a lot of very close races in this country.
I think we're going to hear a little bit from the campaigns. We have NPR's Tamara Keith with Hillary Clinton in New York and NPR's Sarah McCammon with Donald Trump in New York City. I want to start with Sarah McCammon because right now those numbers are looking good for Donald Trump. What is the feeling there?
You know, from people I'm talking to, they're seeing how tight this race is, and especially in some of the places like Virginia, where it wasn't supposed to be so tight at this point, and where Hillary Clinton was favored, and just the fact that there's so much that's still uncertain. A lot of people here are feeling really good, and they say, you know, the fact that this is this tight, and no one expected Trump, you know, to do very well from the beginning, that we are at this point on election night where it is this close, they're feeling good about that. They think that, you know, as those results come in, that Trump is ultimately going to win. And I spoke with a Virginia state campaign director for Trump, you know, where we're still waiting for results. And he said not long ago, Trump was trailing Hillary Clinton in Virginia polls, but his team has been working really hard to capitalize on some enthusiasm they saw there for him. And he's also feeling optimistic.
We're going to switch gears now and bring in NPR's Tamara Keith, who's with the Clinton campaign. Tam, what are people telling you right now? Things are closer than they probably wanted them to be or expected they'd be.
That is correct. And there's a thing about Democrats. They are sort of notorious bedwetters where any sign of trouble causes them to get very, very stressed out. And that seems to be what's happening here right now. A little while ago, was with some of Hillary Clinton's friends from elementary school and high school. And they were concerned that the results were coming in too slow and they didn't know what to expect. And they were nervous. You know, they've been through this before, not all the way to this level, but they've been through this before and saw her lose in the primaries in 2008. I also met a couple as they
sounds
were
like something's happening
walking
in the background
out.
There.
Yes, someone has projected New Mexico going to Hillary Clinton, and the people here are happy about that. So I was talking to this couple as they were leaving a VIP area, and they said that in that VIP area, it is very tense, that people are nervous, and they were actually, this couple were going home because the wife said she felt too sick to keep watching here, and she decided she would rather be nervous at home. But I also talked to Donna Brazile. Oh, I didn't talk to her. I listen to Donna Brazile try to ease someone's mind. And she was pulling all these papers out of her purse, showing showing the times that races had been called in past years and for each state. And she said, quote, "We're hitting the panic button too soon." Cecile Richards from Planned Parenthood walked by and she said, "It's going to be a late night and people are understandably tense because this is a close race, but that people just have to get ready to stay up late."
And this is a big turnaround from the last few days where you really had the Clinton campaign kind of crowing about early voting numbers, right, Tam?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they were, even, you know, an hour and a half ago, they were crowing about early voting numbers. And now, all of the aides that were so friendly not that long ago have completely disappeared from view.
Right. We're not going to say our phones aren't ringing either, but our phones kind of aren't ringing right now. And Ron Elving, I'm going to bring you in here. When campaigns start to go quiet, what does that mean?
It means that they're regrouping. They're talking to each other. They're trying to figure out what's going on. They're trying to get a line of talk put together so that they can all get behind that particular line of talk and look for the best face that they can put on a situation that has really deteriorated for the Democrats in the last couple of hours. Not too terribly long ago, in the 7 o'clock hour, we were noting that Georgia was too close to call, and parenthetically, it still has not been called. North Carolina, Clinton had a lead. Florida, Clinton had a lead. If she were to win any of those three states, it would really put Donald Trump behind the eight ball. But over the course of the next 90 minutes, much changed. Donald Trump moved ahead in Florida and now looks like he might be just a little bit too far out in front to be caught with almost all the vote counted in Florida, although, as we have said many times, we are always very slow to make any commitment about Florida. He does seem to be ahead in North Carolina. We still have some votes to count there. And perhaps the thing that is absolutely shocking Democrats more than any other is that some of the states they were really counting on, like Virginia and New Hampshire, were really slow to turn around. And while I believe Hillary Clinton now has a very narrow lead in Virginia, she was behind there through most of the evening. And New Hampshire is still just terribly close, no calling that. Pennsylvania looks okay so far, but Michigan and Wisconsin, Donald Trump is running ahead, an absolute necessity for Hillary Clinton, both of those states.
Ron, stay right there because we want to bring in another voice, former Trump advisor Barry Bennett. Can you hear me, sir?
I can.
So earlier this year when we reached out to you, you talked about what was going on with the Trump campaign in terms of ground game. You raised some concerns there. What are you thinking now?
Well, obviously, you know, if we learned anything in this campaign cycle, it is to expect the unexpected. And, you know, the voices of the hurting are being heard tonight in ways that we never really quite imagined.
So what does that mean for folks out there like yourself, consultants, people that people have often described as being part of the establishment? What does this mean for where the party's headed?
I think we've proved a lot of people who think that they were really smart aren't. I mean, what we're seeing in Michigan and Wisconsin and Virginia, I mean, it's right in the head of the knife, let alone North Carolina and Florida. I mean, it's stunning. It's a testament to how angry people are at Washington, and Washington had better hear it.
It also means a fundamental change in the direction of the party, right? With Donald Trump's plank essentially being more anti-trade, anti-immigration, how do you see that being reconciled going forward?
Well, certainly on trade. I mean, you know, don't forget that Mitt Romney was for self-deportation, so there's not much of a change. But trade, I mean, Republicans should never talk about trade the way they used to ever again, because, you know, even if you look at places like Ohio, where, you know, Rob Portman, who was a former trade rep and a trade lawyer himself, he ran some pretty strong commercials bashing China for...
Right, but the business community was such a huge part of the party, right? I mean, is this a rejection of that?
No. Perhaps we've got a little aligned too closely with business and not with the people. So maybe this is a shift back, which would be good for the party.
You've said before that the Freedom Caucus in the House, which was sort of full of the sort of Tea Party element of Republicans that had gone to Congress, you said that that caucus will grow after tonight. What does that mean for the functioning of Congress?
Well, I think that, you know, there will certainly be more people who are willing to fight. I mean, Congress is full of people who are unwilling to risk their pensions to do the right thing. this new crop of folks, you know, like in Florida 18, we just beat a Democrat seat, Brian Mast, who just got elected tonight. Brian is a great example. I mean, Brian is coming to Washington to fix things, not to get a pension.
But just to stop you there, I think people have looked at Congress the last couple of years and seen plenty of people willing to fight, right, to the point of dysfunction.
Well, I mean, but perhaps we'll finally get a majority of people who are willing to do the right thing.
Now, what does this mean for Donald Trump's enemies? We know that list is fairly long, but there are some Republicans on it, and I suspect over the next couple of months they're going to feel it one way or another.
It's the Full Employment Act for never-Trumpers, likely. They'll all be getting contracts somewhere.
Oh, right, never-Trumpers. You know, okay, what do they do now?
Yeah, so apparently they're all going to work on the networks. You know, I think that if Trump needs to show some humility tonight if he wins and reach out to folks and, you know, and do what's best for America. But, you know, it is disappointing that there were a lot of Republicans who, you know, couldn't, you know, hold their nose to hear them say it and vote for him. That's very disappointing.
Barry Bennett, thank you so much for speaking with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So NPR's Ron Elving is here in the studio with us. Ron, what did you hear in that conversation?
A former Trump advisor. That list is actually quite long, but.
He was talking about how the Republican Party, we don't know what the outcome is going to be tonight, but Trump is performing better than many had expected. What does this mean for the future of the party? What does it mean for people like Paul Ryan, who was reelected tonight? We don't know if he'll be speaker, but there's no love lost between him and Donald Trump.
It's a little hard to imagine Paul Ryan returning as Speaker to serve with President Donald Trump. It's a little bit hard to imagine how that relationship would go forward.
But how come with the Vice President Mike Pence? Those guys are buddies.
Maybe they make that the line of communication. It's not really clear to what degree Donald Trump has plans to be a real hands-on kind of president dealing with Congress on a daily basis. He might very well delegate that job to Mike Pence, and he might very well concentrate on other aspects of the presidency. That's a possibility. So possibly Paul Ryan and a Trump-Pence administration could work out some sort of modus vivendi and they could go forward. But the first thing Paul Ryan will need to do is get reelected by a House Republican caucus that looks like it's going to be not much smaller than it was before and still have about 40 votes of people who are not terribly enamored of Paul Ryan, called the Freedom Caucus. And if they decided to get behind another candidate, that could be a problem for Paul Ryan. So even with a clean sweep of the presidency, the Senate, and the House, Paul Ryan's problems are not necessarily over.
Go ahead. Sue Davis, I feel like we should bring you in here because this is like your bailiwick, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you're looking at this tonight, you're hearing a guy like Barry Bennett sound like not totally stoked, you know, a little subdued. What do you see going forward, the politics, so to speak, back and forth within the Republican Party?
Well, what's so interesting, if you remember, Paul Ryan, after the Access Hollywood tapes broke, the Speaker said he would no longer campaign or defend Donald Trump and kind of went silent on him in the closing weeks of the race. Mm-hmm. Just in the last 48 hours, Paul Ryan came out again and said he would vote for Trump, that he did have his support, and that he was encouraging Republicans to vote for him. And he said, I don't want to be a reason for Republican disunity. So in the close, Paul Ryan really came on board. I think it is in part because, as Ron referred to, Trump running better in his home state of Wisconsin. And you don't want to step too far out of line with your own party's voters. Early indications tonight are that House Republicans are going to have a very good night. The broader the majority Paul Ryan has, the safer a position he's going to be. And he has declared that he is going to run for Speaker again.
But what does that mean, Ron, for the never-Trumpers? People who absolutely, they drew the line in the sand and they said, not this guy. It sounds like perhaps either publicly or privately, many of those people in the end got on board.
Yes, many of the voters did get on board, and many of the Denver Trumpers just kind of got quiet and decided to let the voters speak, and perhaps secretly hoping that the voters would reject Donald Trump. And they're going to have to decide how they play this if Donald Trump does indeed win and if he is going to set the agenda for the Republican Party. But whether he wins or loses, whether Donald Trump is president or not, the Republican Party is going to have to take a long look at itself, look at how it won this election, look at how it is doing demographically with the growing parts of the population and the growing parts of the country, and it's going to have to say, can we go forward indefinitely with a shrinking white majority?
It's a closer race than a lot of people thought it was going to be tonight, Audie.
Right, and you may want to know what's happening in your state. You can head to npr.org where you can see county-level results. Thank you for listening to your public radio station. And stay with us as we're going to have more updates throughout the night. I'm Audie Cornish, and joining me now is Carrie Brown of member station WFU. She's at Senator Richard Burr's headquarters in North Carolina. He's running for re-election in the state. And Carrie, people have been watching North Carolina very closely, especially in the early voting days. What do you know so far?
They have been. I mean, right here, the crowd erupted as soon as the race was called for Senator Burr. Gun rights has been a big wedge issue in this campaign with him. They've talked a lot about that and the economy and just national security. As we know, the senator has also aligned himself closely with Donald Trump. There were concerns that maybe that would hurt him, but a lot of supporters here I talked with weren't concerned about that. As we've seen, obviously, his campaign's been successful. His campaign manager tells me they hit the ground hard this time around. He started late, but obviously, they, as an incumbent, he had a little bit of an advantage and has made up for that. So we are awaiting for his arrival here. He lives down the street from my location and where I'm at right now in Forsyth County, and should be here at any time to greet his supporters.
Hey, Carrie, you said that Senator Burr has been a supporter of Donald Trump. So what has that looked like, practically speaking? I mean, has he talked a lot about Donald Trump on the trail?
At times he has, when he's been asked about it. He hasn't been extremely vocal about it, but he definitely has supported him when asked about it. So, you know, he hasn't kept that back from people, but at the same time, he hasn't been broadcasting it every single time he's out and about. But he definitely has stood by him during this campaign. And as I said, a lot of people were wondering, would that hurt or would that help him? But as we're seeing tonight, it obviously did not hurt him. Also, you know, the Supreme Court, there's been a lot of talk about that in regards to this being important, because as we know, you know, it could shape the future of the Supreme Court. So Burr has talked a lot about that in the sense of, you know, possibly blocking if a Democrat would win. But he's kind of walked back some of those statements lately. So we will see. This is obviously a big win for Republicans and for North Carolina in a lot of supporters' eyes.
I was going to ask how far he's gone with that. I know the senator was one of those few lawmakers who went out and said, well, maybe we can have a vacancy on that court for an entire Clinton presidency, should that happen.
Yeah, it has been a talk, and, you know, he has not been shy about saying that. He did get some heat in the end of this race because it was so tight. You know, I think he kind of, again, walked back a little bit of that. But he's definitely a strong supporter with conservative values and views, and so I think he's going to probably stick with that now that he's won. One thing to mention, I'll be curious to talk with him when he gets here, when he addresses the crowd. He has mentioned earlier this year that if he won this third term, that he would retire after this term. So it'll be interesting to see, you know,
if he really does.
If he will follow through.
We'll have to leave it there. Carrie Brown of member station WFU. She's at Senator Richard Burr's headquarters in North Carolina. You're listening to special coverage of election 2016. Stay with us. This is NPR News.
Rachel Martin in Washington tonight with Robert Siegel. I'm Tom Cran, Minnesota Public Radio News. Mike Mulcahy, our political editor, is here as we get more numbers in now around Minnesota. Mike, give us an update on what you're seeing.
Well, 10% of the precincts reporting now in the presidential contest in Minnesota, and Hillary Clinton has 51% of the vote to Donald Trump's 41.
Okay.
And then we're looking at some of these congressional races that we've been watching, three competitive races, really. In the 3rd District, Western Suburbs, Eric Paulson, the Republican, 56% of the vote. Terry Bonoff, the Democrat, 44%, and 56% of the precincts are reporting there. Now, some of the other congressional districts we've been watching, the 2nd District, only 3% of the precincts reporting, and Jason Lewis, the Republican, has a very slight lead over Democrat Angie Craig. That's an open seat. And then in the 8th District, again, only 2% of the precincts reporting, Rick Nolan, with a lead of just about 100 votes or less over Stuart Mills right now. So still a lot of votes to be counted right here in Minnesota, Tom.
And still a very tight presidential race as we continue to monitor that. Republican Chuck Grassley in Iowa has been reelected to the Senate. Wisconsin Senate race between Senator Ron Johnson and Democratic challenger Russ Feingold. Too close to call. Johnson has a slight lead at the moment. A
couple state house races, interesting. Nolan West appears to have won up in Blaine.
920.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2016 election. I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Rachel Martin. Polls are now closed in 44 states. And here's what we know at this point. Donald Trump is leading the Electoral College vote thanks to wins in 17 states, including Montana. Clinton has won 10 states, including New York.
As far as Electoral College, Donald Trump has 140 votes and Clinton has 104. We're waiting for several key swing states to be called, including Virginia, Georgia, North Carolina, we think, and Florida.
When it comes to Congress, we're watching several competitive races. In the Senate, Republican Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina has been reelected, according to the Associated Press. That was a seat Democrats were hoping to capture. Republicans have also held on to seats in North Carolina and Florida.
Democrats have so far taken only one Republican-held seat in Illinois. And in the House, the early signs are looking good for Republicans to keep that chamber. Stay with us. We'll be updating you throughout the night. Right now, we want to turn to our reporters, Sue Davis and Asma Khalid. And Sue, just because you've done so much on Congress, what are some of the surprises of the night?
I think one of the surprises of the night is just how close these races are. I think the fact that, particularly when we look at places like Pennsylvania and New Hampshire, states that we expected to have stronger Democratic turnout, in part because they are tend to vote Democratic and by wide margins in presidential elections. Also, two states with incredibly significant Senate races, both of those races, incumbent Republican Senator in Pennsylvania, Pat Toomey, incumbent Kelly Ayotte in New Hampshire. How those races go will be hugely decisive in deciding which party controls the Senate. We could say on a macro level at this point in the evening, Republicans up and down the ballot are performing well. I will give you one example in the House. Incumbent Republican Congressman Carlos Curbelo, he is a Hispanic Republican. He represents a heavily Hispanic district that voted for President Barack Obama twice, and he won re-election tonight. And that is not a good sign for Democrats in Florida, up or down the ballot.
Asma Khalid, you have been looking at demographics. I mean, we've been talking first off just about North Carolina. This is a big win for Republican Senator Richard Burr. What's happening in that state as you've been looking into it when it comes to who's showing up at the polls?
So one thing I have been really interested in throughout this campaign has been how white college-educated voters would be voting this election cycle. And I say that partly because, you know, even though I guess we're talking about Burr, I would say in some ways these white college-educated voters would traditionally be thought to be Republican voters. In fact, if we go back in exit polls, historically we've seen them vote for the Republican presidential candidate. But Hillary Clinton was polling much better nationally with this group. There was some thought that she could even win this group nationally. Mm-hmm. And if we look at North Carolina, if we compare white college-educated voters this year, according to the, you know, exit polls we have to date, she is doing much better than how President Obama did in 2008 when he won the state of North Carolina.
But still perhaps not good enough.
Perhaps, but I would say that that could be because of other groups. I actually think that the white college-educated vote will be key. Take a county like Wake County. Mm. So Wake County is actually where Hillary Clinton held her last rally of the night into the wee hours of this morning in Raleigh. That's a county that President Obama won by 10 percentage points. So far, it looks like Hillary Clinton is up by more than 20 percentage points. It's also the second most highly educated county in the state of North Carolina.
But I think the big question of the night has also been about Hillary Clinton's ability to hold together the so-called Obama coalition, right? The minority voters, the millennial voters, as you mentioned, maybe white college-educated voters. What are we seeing so far that says whether or not she can accomplish that?
So far, at least in a state like North Carolina, there are some positive signs for her with this white college-educated vote. You know, I think every analyst had said that they didn't anticipate she would do as well with African-American voters in terms of turnout. She would likely win them by a very large margin, but really, could she match the turnout that the country
but
has seen?
But it's not just them, right? There's the millennial voters,
that's
too.
I was just going to jump to. So the millennials, and I was just looking at that in the state of Florida. Millennials are a key problem for Hillary Clinton in some very important states like Florida. I mean, I was just looking at the data there, and she is doing about 11 points worse than what President Obama did in the state of Florida with millennials. That President Obama actually outperformed himself nationally among Florida. More young people supported him in 2012, and Hillary Clinton is not doing as well. If we look at where some of that vote has gone, about 7%, according to the exit polls, either chose a third-party candidate or they declined to answer that they voted either Clinton or Trump.
We are all watching this election closely. Wall Street is also watching the election very closely. And to get reaction on that front, we are joined now by NPR's John Itzde, who is on the line now. John, how are the markets responding to the development so far this evening?
Well, the prospects of a Trump presidency are roiling the global financial markets. They had been up over the last couple days, as it looked like, and as polls predicted that Hillary Clinton was going to be the likely winner. Now that it looks like a Trump presidency is more likely, they're tanking. The Dow futures are down about 3.5%, over 600 points. In Japan, the Nikkei average is down about 2.25 points, and in China, the Hang Seng index is down 2 points. So, big reaction.
What is that a response to? Why would more likely Donald Trump presidency be so destabilizing?
It's all about uncertainty. Market investors are uncertain about the policies that Donald Trump will have with regard to the economy and the budget and financial the financial system. So they are when markets are uncertain, they retreat, and that's what's happening now. You remember a couple weeks ago when the first FBI report came out saying they were reopening their investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails, the markets declined. In fact, the S&P 500 fell over a nine-day period, nine consecutive days, that fell 3 percentage points. Then when the FBI announced this past weekend that they hadn't found anything, no evidence to warrant charges against Clinton, the markets bounced back up in the last couple of days. Now, once again, uncertainty about Donald Trump's policies are causing the markets to decline.
And just as a point of clarification, the markets, I believe, have fallen 2 percentage points.
2 percentage points since when? I'm sorry?
I think that's just what we're trying to clarify. Give us the latest, John, about what the markets are doing right now.
Well, the Nikkei is down 2.25 points in Japan, and the Hang Seng index is down about 2%. But the Dow futures, predicting where the market will be in the U.S. tomorrow, are down about 3.5%, almost 3.5%.
And here's John Itzde, who's been following the financial impact of the results so far this evening. And I'm going to bring in NPR's Ron Elving at this point. Ron, you just heard reaction from Wall Street. The prospect of a Donald Trump presidency is more destabilizing. What are you seeing out there right now in terms of what his path forward is? Is it more clear than it was a few hours ago?
It is more clear in the sense that the problems that Hillary Clinton has been having with her blue wall, these are the states we expected her to win that would put her at least on the brink, if not over the 270 mark. The problems that she's been having in those states continue. Virginia looking a little better for her, but New Hampshire is still a big question mark. She is still behind in Michigan. She is still behind in Wisconsin.
You just said Michigan, so I'm going to pause and bring in Zoe Clark from Michigan Radio because she is there, and I want you to jump in with this as well, Ron. She's the host of It's Just Politics at Michigan Radio. And Zoe, what are you hearing so far? This is quite close, right?
This is incredibly close, and little did we think, you know, just a few mere hours ago that Michigan was going to be quite this close. You know, Michigan has gone Democratic, gone blue in the past six election cycles. But over the past few days during this election, we've seen numerous visits from candidates, and I think this must show what internals were showing, that Michigan is a lot closer than we necessarily thought it was going to be at this point.
Six election cycles. Ron Elving, how much of a surprise is this? Or are there stuff that is it sort of baked into the demographics of Michigan, maybe, that is having us have a different conversation about it tonight?
As we just heard, Michigan has been attracting a lot of attention from both campaigns in recent days. Now, Donald Trump has gone to a lot of places that may not be gettable for him tonight, like Minnesota, but he has found some success, apparently, in putting back in place states like Wisconsin and Michigan, where we have a lot of those blue-collar workers who feel displaced, who feel that they have lost standing, who feel that trade deals, as Donald Trump has characterized them, have cost them some of their economic leverage and made them less viable in the economy and taken them farther away from achieving what they see as the American dream.
Zoe Clark, what should we be looking for? What parts of the state kind of lean in these different directions?
Right, absolutely. Well, I mean, I want to jump on that Macomb County, of course, which is, you know, infamous, famous, the birthplace of the Reagan Democrat. We're keeping an eye on Macomb County right now. Only 11% has come in, but Trump up 16 points there. We're also looking at Oakland County, though. Oakland County is a really big swing county in Michigan. Right now, we're at two-thirds of precincts in, and Hillary Clinton is up 8 points. So, you know, this thing is close here in Michigan.
What were you hearing from voters these last few days? I mean, was there any sense of the direction things were going?
Well, I mean, look, you know, this is the state that went for Bernie Sanders back in March for the primary, and everyone, I mean, I think, but a few folks thought that it was basically just Hillary Clinton's to go. I think, you know, 538 had it at 99% Hillary to win. So what we're noticing here in Michigan, this election cycle, is we come up with a lot of ideas about, you know, how the story is going to end, but it turns out we just haven't seen this movie before.
We're going to turn now to Sue Davis in the studio, who has an update. Sue?
Just a quick update on the electoral vote counts. Donald Trump has won Montana and Missouri, bringing his total to 150 electoral votes. Hillary Clinton has won New Mexico, bringing her total to 109 electoral votes.
Ralph Reed is the chairman of the Faith and Freedom Coalition. He endorsed Donald Trump. He is a leading evangelical in this country. He's on the line now. Mr. Reed, how are you feeling at this point about Donald Trump's path forward in the race?
Well, it's fascinating. It's going to be very, very close. You know, the main media organizations have not been able to call Florida or Georgia or Ohio or North Carolina. It looks like it's going to be a long night. But the preliminary evidence from the exit polling is that the evangelical vote came, and it came very heavily for Donald Trump. Just real quickly, in Florida, they were one out of every five votes. They voted 85% to 13% for Donald Trump, the highest ever recorded for a presidential candidate in that state. In Georgia, they were a third of the vote. They voted incredibly 88% to 6% for Donald Trump. And in Wisconsin, not known as an evangelical stronghold, they were roughly one out of every six votes. They voted 71% to 24%. For Donald Trump. It's ironic. It isn't what I would have predicted, or I think what most people would have predicted at the beginning of this election cycle. But if Donald Trump prevails tonight, this vote will be one of the main reasons why.
Why has a thrice married man who says he is a Presbyterian by tradition, but hasn't exactly led a life that has been an example of evangelical Christian values, what have evangelicals seen in him?
Well, I think the best answer to that question can be summed up in two words, and that's Hillary Clinton. I think that the things that she stood for, you may remember in the third debate, defending late-term abortions, getting the endorsement of Planned Parenthood in the primaries, saying that she was in favor of taxpayer funding of abortions, saying that she would appoint no one to the Supreme Court who didn't agree in advance not to revisit Roe v. Wade.
And you're convinced that Donald Trump wouldn't change his mind again on where he stands on abortion?
Well, I will just say this. You know, none of us can predict what someone's going to do in the future, but if he were to betray the public promise that he made not only to voters of faith, but he made to the American people in that third debate where he said that he was going to appoint strict constructionists to the court in the model of Antonin Scalia, and he's the only candidate ever of either party to release a list of 20 names from which he said he would choose. None of us can predict what anyone will do, but I think to go back on a pledge that public and that binding is just not politically possible.
Very briefly, can Donald Trump be a unifier?
I think whoever wins this election can be a unifier. I think that this is, I guess I'm in the minority. There have been nasty elements to this campaign, but I think these have been two formidable, tough candidates, neither one of whom quit. And I think we'll come together as a country no matter who wins tonight.
Ralph Reed, chairman of the Faith and Freedom Coalition, thanks so much for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to live election coverage from NPR News. I'm Audie Cornish. You're listening to live election coverage. And joining us now is Democratic Congressman Keith Ellison of Minnesota. Congressman, can you hear me?
Oh, yeah. How are you?
Well, the question is, how are you? You've been out there campaigning for Hillary Clinton. Are you seeing the numbers you had hoped for?
Well, you know what? It's a long night. We got many more to count, many more votes to count. Virginia just came in for Hillary Clinton. That's good news. And we're just going to keep on looking at the polls as they come in. We've done great work. We knocked on doors. We turned out the vote as best we could. And at this point, it's up to the voter. I feel positive. I feel optimistic. But at this point, you know, I think we all just got to see how this thing's going to shake out.
Earlier in the night, one of our reporters spoke to Donald Trump's Virginia state campaign chairman, who said this, that this is a working-class revolution of blue-collar workers in America who have had enough with the establishment, Wall Street, cheap labor, slave trade cabal that controls America. This sounds suspiciously like the candidate you originally supported, Bernie Sanders. Do Democrats have a problem with this group?
Well, look, there's no doubt that we got to return to a high wage economy where collective bargaining is respected and we have a fair economy and a ladder up. But if that's that man's conclusion, how then do you arrive at Donald Trump? I mean, this guy does not pay his workers. He has a whole slew of contractors who he has left behind in bankruptcy. He won't even tell the American people what his income taxes are. I mean, to say that Donald Trump is your working class hero is quite a remarkable thing.
But I think Democrats tonight are finding out that they may be having a problem with voters, particularly white voters, without college degrees. How do you address this going forward, especially if your candidate can't necessarily turn out the same numbers of minority and young other voters that President Obama did?
Well, I think there's no question that whenever things like the minimum wage are on the ballot, they win. You know, there's no doubt about it that, you know, we have got to really embrace the economic viability of working class people.
So you're hoping to go issue by issue. You're not counting on the personality at the top of the ticket.
Well, I mean, look, it's just against my constitution to hang everything on a charismatic personality. I don't really believe in those kind of politics. I know that people fall for it sometimes, but I think over time, people really want to know, what are you going to do for them? Am I going to be able to retire? Can my kids go to college? Can I pay my rent? I think that's what people really want to know. And I am sure, and I've been knowing this long before tonight, that this is something that we gotta make sure that everyone knows that the Democratic Party is the party of working people. And we got to make sure that message is driven home.
It's Democratic Congressman Keith Ellison of Minnesota. We're still waiting on returns from that state. You're listening to live election coverage from NPR News.
This is live election coverage from Minnesota Public Radio News, and we can say that Keith Ellison has won his reelection race tonight. One of the few races that we've called so far, but Keith Ellison defeated Republican Frank Drake. I'm Mike Mulcahy here with Tom Cran.
Good evening. Election night 2016 from Minnesota Public Radio News.
And Tom, we're watching some of these other congressional races. Again, we have the most results in for the third district race of the competitive House U.S. House races. And their Republican incumbent, Eric Paulson, has a lead of 56 to 44 over DFLer Terry Bonoff with 70% of the precincts reporting. So Paulson is in good shape. I have a couple other results from the state legislature. In the state Senate, the Republican minority leader David Hahn has been defeated by Democrat Steve Swadzinski. So we know that, that's in the Eden Prairie area.
Mm-hmm.
In the House, an interesting result. Nolan West, he's a Republican candidate in Blaine. He has won tonight. And you remember he sparked some controversy with some social media posts.
That's right.
That were basically criticizing Abraham Lincoln and praising the Confederacy. And there was just a flap in the last week or so about whether Republican groups had pulled out of that race or were still investing in it. And they were still investing in it. And Nolan West has won tonight. So,
as we continue, we'll continue to monitor whether it is the three very competitive House races, the balance of power in the legislature, and the presidential race, a very tight one tonight.
From NPR News, this is special coverage of the 2016 election. I'm Rachel Martin.
And I'm Audie Cornish. In the race for the White House, it could be a long night of counting.
It is still too early to call states like Virginia, North Carolina, and Florida. That could hold the keys to the White House. But as for one key state, Ohio, we can say it is projected to go for Donald Trump.
And stock futures are tumbling as the race remains up in the air. We'll get you an update on all the races, including those for control of the House and Senate. Stay with us for more.
We are going to turn now, though, to NPR's Sue Davis, who is in the studio with us. We just heard a couple of headlines about where we stand right now, Sue, but give us the broader picture. What's going on right now?
The most significant movement right now is Ohio has been called for Donald Trump. It's 18 electoral votes go to him, giving him a lead of 168 votes to Hillary Clinton's 109 electoral votes. Ohio was an absolute must win for Donald Trump in his path to the White House. He is also polling the votes in Florida and are increasingly competitive right now. However, Virginia and Colorado are two states where Hillary Clinton is in the lead and will be incredibly crucial. The important thing to remember in Donald Trump's path tonight is he still must flip a Democratic state that went for President Obama in 2012. So that's a Pennsylvania, a Michigan, a lot of people talking about Michigan and what's going to happen there, or a Nevada. Some place like that is still necessary for him to clinch 270.
Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Nevada, which is more likely, Ron, if there were to be one?
Well, right now we're looking at numbers in Michigan that have to really scare the Democratic Party because they are several points behind. Now, there are votes to be counted in Wayne County. There are votes to be counted elsewhere in the state. I don't believe we've reached 50% of the count yet in Michigan. The other state that is causing a heart attack for a lot of Democrats is Wisconsin. Responsible polling there showed it a 6-point race in recent days, and yet Donald Trump is ahead in Wisconsin. Again, we have not seen most of the votes counted, but it is a surprising lead for Donald Trump at this point in the state of Wisconsin. Now, Nevada is a state where there was a great deal of early voting, and the Democrats felt very good about the Hispanic portion of that early voting,
Let's
and they thought it was going to
Sue
help
Davis
them.
Jump in here for a second. You have a call?
We have another major battleground that's been called. The state of Virginia has been called for Hillary Clinton. That gives her 122 electoral votes to Donald Trump's 168. This was a critical win for Hillary Clinton. A Donald Trump victory here would have been hugely significant for him. She has thrown up a roadblock in his path to 270, but he still has the advantage, 168 to 122.
Well, it still sounds like they've each won the states that they need to win.
Yeah, although, you know, in Ohio, this was a state that in the polls, at least, was polling dead even. And that this was something we heard a lot about in the campaign, in this campaign, was ground game. Mm-hmm. And that Hillary Clinton was supposed to have better organization on the ground, mm-hmm. better get out the vote, and better voter contact. And that did not come through for her tonight in Ohio.
But there was a senator there, a Republican senator, who had those things, right? What lessons have we learned about the down ballot performance, right? It matters what those guys did a lot.
Yes. And in the Senate races, Republicans so far are having a very good night. Republican incumbents in Florida and Ohio have held on to their seats. An open seat in Indiana, Republicans held on to. And incumbent Richard Burr in one of the toss-up races held North Carolina, throwing up a major roadblock for Democrats in their bid to take over the Senate. Democrats in the Senate have net gained one seat tonight. They need three more if Hillary Clinton wins the night in the White House, and they need four more if Donald Trump wins. And if Donald Trump is winning, it is very unlikely that Democrats would be able to do that.
Let's bring in NPR's Sarah McCammon now. She is at Donald Trump's election night gathering. Folks there hope it's a victory celebration that has yet to be determined. Sarah, what's the vibe there? This is turning out to be a closer race than many had thought.
Yes, and I think with Donald Trump going into this race, certainly, and also into election night as the underdog, the fact that it is this race, this close and this much of a nail biter is being seen by people here as a really positive sign for Donald Trump. And, you know, so far there's been a lot of good news for him tonight. And every time a state is called, you hear just an eruption of cheers. Every time a state is called for Trump, you hear an eruption of cheers here. I'm kind of up in a balcony looking down at this ballroom where Trump will speak later tonight, and I see a sea of people, a lot of them in the red Make America Great Again hats, which I saw on Twitter. I haven't verified this myself. They're just being handed out for free here. So there's a lot of energy in the room, a lot of excitement and optimism as the returns come in.
You have been with Donald Trump for much of the campaigning over the last year, and even the last 24 hours, he was all over the place. I mean, he was in Florida, North Carolina, New Hampshire, Pennsylvania. What was your read on what his strategy was in those last couple of days?
You know, it was such a blur, and I have to say we are all going on so little sleep that I had to go back through my Twitter feed to write down all the states he's been to in the last 3 days, because it has been just one after another, five rallies a day the last couple of days.
Something exciting sounds like it just happened there.
Looks like the crowd is cheering again because Fox News is calling North Carolina for Trump. Again, that's Fox News' call, and that's what you're hearing in the background here.
That would be big news. We have yet to confirm that. So when we can do so, we'll bring that information. But yeah, people there enthusiastic.
Very much so. Very much. That's the noise you're hearing.
You know, I want to ask you, Sarah, because you have covered evangelicals as a voting bloc this election. And we heard from Ralph Reed just moments ago talking about what he hopes is a Trump presidency that can promote evangelical values, specifically appoint justices to the Supreme Court who reflect those values. In your conversations with evangelicals, has this been a tough decision for them?
For a lot of them, yes. And in the primary season, a lot of evangelicals that I spoke with were feeling really optimistic about their choices. You know, the most popular primary candidates were generally, if you talk to, you know, conservative Christians, Ted Cruz, Ben Carson, some of them liked Marco Rubio. And, you know, they saw a whole host of candidates in front of them, many of whom would be at least acceptable and palatable, if not exciting. But I heard a lot of angst about Donald Trump. That being said, when it came down to it and the choice was down to Trump and Hillary Clinton, you know, there are a couple things going on. You can't underestimate the dislike for the Clintons that many conservative Christians feel. This goes back to the 90s. This goes back to, it goes back many years. And it also comes down to policy as well. Just the fact that Donald Trump has promised to appoint conservative Supreme Court justices, especially justices that are opposed to legalized abortion, a big, big issue for many evangelicals. And those are kind of the top things they cite. They say, I don't like either candidate. I really dislike Hillary Clinton. And at least Donald Trump is more in line with my values and has promised to uphold them. And so that's kind of where it comes down. People, it's really being painted as a choice between two options, and that's the way many evangelicals have seen this choice.
NPR Sarah McCammon at the Trump campaign. We'll check in with you later, Sarah. We're going to go now to Sue Davis for an update.
We have another quick update. Colorado has been called for Hillary Clinton, bringing her electoral votes to 131. Donald Trump still in the lead with 168 electoral votes. Colorado was favored by Hillary Clinton, partly on the strength that is the most college-educated state in the country outside of the District of Columbia, which is not a state, a huge voting bloc that has been supporting her. And we can also report that Senator John McCain has won re-election to the United States Senate as well.
We want to turn now to Celinda Lake. She's a leading Democratic pollster and strategist. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
So we've been hearing for weeks about this so-called blue wall, the number of states that had gone for President Obama, probably twice, and that this would somehow give her the advantage going in. What's happening?
Well, she can still lose Florida and Ohio and win. What she can't do is lose any more of the big Midwestern states. And I think what's happening is this was always a change-oriented electorate. It's a he is doing better in states and with voters that are still trying to recover from the economy. And I think we're seeing how difficult it is to elect a woman president. So I think all of those things are factoring in. But, you know, she had many routes, has many routes to victory. He had one path, and he had to win Ohio and Florida. She did not.
But you talked about the Midwest. What makes that fertile ground for him, and what makes that so difficult for Democrats right now to essentially make the argument to give us a third term, right, give us a third Democratic White House?
I think the thing that makes the Midwest so difficult is the economy. And that was the region really hit the hardest in the recession. They are the region that felt the least likely to have recovered. His trade policy, his economic policy really had great deal of appeal there. And I think the Democrats face a fundamental challenge, which is we have to have a more robust economic profile. And that will be, when Hillary Clinton is president, that will be a real challenge for her. And it's a challenge for any Democrat who wants to win a governorship there or the presidency there.
Which of these early returns has surprised you?
The closeness of Virginia, frankly, surprised me, particularly with Kane on the ticket. And because Northern Virginia is so strong for her. But, you know, she did win it in the end. And Michigan is surprising. But we still have only a third of the vote in. It looks like there's less of Detroit in than in some of the rural areas. So,
but is it definitely surprising? I mean, when you see the campaign going to these places in the final hours, places where you thought they felt that they were doing pretty well, isn't that a giant red flag?
Well, it certainly is a giant red flag. And if you saw there were some adjustments to the schedule, I think there's a difficulty in Michigan because we had no statewide races. We had no Senate race. We had no governor's race to help get out the vote. And it's a state that doesn't have a lot of early vote. And so we had a steeper hill to climb there, just technically, as well as in terms of message. But certainly, when you see the Trump campaign go into a state, I think the Hillary Clinton campaign took it very seriously. They went back in with ads into Michigan, went back in with ads into Virginia, beefed up their buy in Florida. So they took it very seriously.
Going forward the rest of the night, we know that you've got your finger on the pulse of the numbers. What are you going to be looking for? What is going to have you, you know, have your face to your palm? What is going to get you happy?
What happens in Michigan and what happens in Wisconsin and what happens in Pennsylvania? If we lose a big state like that, it gets to be much, much more difficult to put this together. We can lose a small state, you know, like North Carolina could go either way, but we can't lose a Michigan and pull this it's not very likely to lose a Michigan and pull this out.
Celinda Lake, stay with us for one moment because we have another return here I think you're going to want to respond to. Susan Davis, jump in.
Just a quick update. Donald Trump has been projected to be the winner of Florida, a hugely significant victory for him, leading his electoral vote tally to 197. Hillary Clinton is still at 131.
Celinda Lake, before I let you go, Florida, I know you said that that's one that she doesn't necessarily need to hold on to, but that's got to hurt, right, for the people doing the numbers inside the campaign.
Well, it hurts because of the situation in the other states. I will say this about Florida, and our research showed this. Trump had a very unique relationship with Florida, and Florida always had a different view of him. They knew him. Some of the things that really bothered voters in other states, in Florida, they had a longer relationship with him, and they said, oh, that's just Trump being Trump.
Mm-hmm.
We don't take that seriously. He's not really like that.
So
were more difficult in Florida. But Michigan is very serious.
Celinda Lake, a leading Democratic pollster and strategist, thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
NPR's Ron Elving, that's a big win, Florida, for Donald Trump.
Yes, it is. And it was, as we've said all through the evening, one that one was hesitant to call, but one that certainly the Trump campaign had to have, and very hard to get their numbers together without it. But with it, the path is becoming clearer. He still needs to punch that hole, but he's got two very good prospective places to do it, in Michigan and Wisconsin, where he is running ahead in both those states. Many votes to be counted. But if he can complete the takeover of either of those two blue states, and let's remember, Wisconsin has been voting Democratic in presidential elections since 1988, Michigan since 1992. These are states the Democrats have really come to count on. And even in 2012, when Mitt Romney, a son of Michigan, was the Republican nominee, Barack Obama carried it pretty handily. So that is a big shock, as we've said, to the Democrats. And they also need to bring in either New Hampshire or Nevada, one or the other. And they must hold on to both Michigan and Wisconsin, because all their other pieces are in place, and they have failed to pick up any of the states that they hope to be able to take away from Donald Trump. I don't know if we've called Georgia yet, but Donald Trump does maintain a lead there, even though it's still technically too close to call.
And just to recap for our listeners, right now, NPR has the Electoral College count at Clinton 131, Donald Trump 197. Donald Trump is projected to win Florida. Hillary Clinton is projected to win Colorado and Virginia. We're going to keep you updated throughout the night here and online at NPR.org. You're listening to live coverage from NPR News.
Right here on Minnesota Public Radio News, that is Audie Cornish in Washington. I'm Tom Cran here with Mike Mulcahy in the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom. We are monitoring Minnesota results, and Mike's got his eye on the numbers. And what are you seeing now?
Well, a very tight race for president nationwide, not so tight here in Minnesota right now. Hillary Clinton has a 12-point lead over Donald Trump with 28% of the precincts reporting. Also watching these congressional races in Minnesota tonight, and again, waiting for good numbers. We know that Democrat Keith Ellison has won re-election. Still waiting for more votes to come in some of these contested races, although 87% of the precincts have reported in the 3rd District, and Eric Paulson, the Republican incumbent, has a 57-43% lead over Democrat Terry Bonoff. In the 2nd District, that's the open seat, 11% of precincts reporting, Republican Jason Lewis with a lead, 50-42% over Angie Craig. But again, a lot of votes yet to be counted there. And in the 8th District, 7% of the precincts reported, Stuart Mills leading 52-48 over incumbent Democrat Rick Nolan. But again, Tom, those races way too early to call.
All right, and we'll continue to monitor things here. Just coming up at 10 o'clock, we expect poll closings on the West Coast. And that would be California, and it would be Washington, Oregon, and Idaho are in that group that will close at 10 o'clock. In the meantime, as we have been saying, we have reporters covering across the state and around the region, including our Brian Bax, who is with the DFLers tonight in Minneapolis at the Hilton. What is the mood there, Brian Baxt?
Tom, I would describe it as jittery. There's a lot of long faces. People are glued to their phones and watching the screens, and there's cheers that go up when the states are called for Hillary Clinton, but a lot of straight faces when Donald Trump has been proclaimed the victor in a lot of states. All of the heavyweights from the party have been kind of gathering here one by one, with Governor Mark Dayton and Lieutenant Governor Tina Smith and the mayors of Minneapolis and St. Paul all telling people here to keep their spirits up. They know it's going to be a long night, but they folks here are definitely not as jubilant as they were at the beginning of the night.
All right, our Brian Baxt with DFL headquarters tonight in Minneapolis as we continue to monitor the numbers and bring you the latest from the Minnesota Public Radio Newsroom. Tom Cran here with Mike Mulcahy.
And this map, the national map for the presidential race, really incredible. Donald Trump has won Florida. He has won Ohio. Hillary Clinton has won Virginia and Colorado. And so we're just keeping an eye on these battleground states. The other ones still too close to call at this point.
And those would remain North Carolina, Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin. We continue to keep our eyes on that as well. And I should say that we have reporter Tim Pugmire at with GOP headquarters in Bloomington as well. And we're going to be checking in with him throughout the evening as well as we continue our coverage here on Minnesota Public Radio News. Senate race in Wisconsin. Still too close to call, although Senator Ron Johnson is in the lead over challenger Russ Feingold, who is challenging him to return to the U.S. Senate in a seat that he held previously. Also, Republican Chuck Grassley in Iowa has been reelected. We've got our eye on the Senate as well as the state legislature, too, for you tonight.
Right, and a couple of results to report in the state legislature. David Hand, the incumbent Senate Republican leader, was defeated tonight by his DFL challenger, Steve Swadzinski. I can also tell you Nolan West, a Republican, seems to have won a House seat in Blaine.
All right. It's Minnesota Public Radio News. A minute now before 10 p.m., and this is Minnesota Public Radio News, 91.1 KNOW, Minneapolis, St. Paul, with full results online at mprnews.org. Make us your second screen tonight. Michael Cahill.
Let me give you one other state House result. Andrew Carlson, the Democrat, has won a seat in Bloomington, defeating Republican Chad Anderson, who won in a special election.
All right, and we'll keep our eyes on that as well, and we'll continue to look at these contested or the competitive House races. That would be the 2nd District and the 8th District as well, and we have our reporters Mark Sedeklik and Dan Crocker there at both Nolan and Stuart Mills headquarters, and when we have something for you there, we'll tell you. Mike?
We should say Republican Congressman Tom Emmer has won his race, too, over Democrat David Snyder in the 6th District.
All right, and it is 10 p.m. in Minnesota.